This is WCSX Online. Our live web stream begins in 15 seconds. Need a new roof? Click on our Mr. Roof link and enter to win a new roof. Compliments of Mr. Roof.
Stimulate the economy. We'll have predictable energy prices and therefore a solid economy. We won't be subsidizing almost $1 trillion a year to the richest corporations in the history of commerce, which is what we're doing today. And that's money that is $2,700 for every man, woman, and child in America every single year. For that kind of money, we could build 1,500 schools in every state of the union every single year and provide health insurance for the 45 million Americans that have none. So we'd have a much, much healthier economy and a much, much healthier environment.
You've been working on the environment for many years. Is there beginning to be a shift from environmental activists as outsiders to sort of the next phase where the mainstream actually begins not only to enter into the picture, but to innovate in ways that even environmental activists never imagined were possible?
You're absolutely right. It can't just be a small group of the choir that delivers these kinds of innovations, both in terms of the policy and the technology. And when you unleash the American ingenuity, it's an amazing result. And I do think that it is becoming mainstream. About 3 or 4 months ago, I opened up my Sunday newspaper, and there's a little insert that I think is in many newspapers around the country. It's called the Parade magazine. And it's very, very mainstream recipes on how to decorate your house for Halloween. Well, the cover of that insert magazine was about global warming. And it was actually one of the best summaries of the global warming issue I've read. But it also talked about why you should care. It pointed out that if we continue to have more intense storms like Katrina, your homeowner's insurance will go up in price. It talked about energy prices. It talked about a lot of other consequences to you. And then it said, here are things you can do about it. And it was a very good list of ways that you can lower your own carbon emissions and save money by becoming more energy efficient. So I think that when you see these kinds of issues being discussed in mainstream publications like that and the success of Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie, I have great hope for the next few years for us solving these problems and tackling them as a nation, not just as a few environmental advocates.
Terry Tamminen, Energy and Environmental Policy Advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. In a moment, former Assistant to Energy Secretary Joseph Rome.
Cellulosic ethanol and plug-in hybrids, these are two phrases that if your listeners haven't heard before, they're certainly going to hear a great deal of in the years to come.
You're listening to A World of Possibilities, a production of the Mainstream Media Project. To hear the podcast of this program and to access our show archives, please visit our website at aworldofpossibilities.com or visit iTunes.
What does all this mean for the economy of California? Will greater regulation of greenhouse gas emissions put a damper on economic growth, as some climate change skeptics insist? Will reducing dependence on oil result in job cuts around the state? Joe Rome, former Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration, argues that economic opportunities abound for companies that invest in renewable energy resources and develop green technologies. Author of the book Cool Companies, he says that once corporations recognize climate change is inevitable, they'll race to be the first to develop technological strategies to help reduce carbon emissions. And he says those companies that succeed stand to make a lot of money. Joe Rome joins us now from his home in Washington, D.C.
Climate change is inevitable. And once you know something is inevitable, you really want to go first. You want your businesses to develop the technologies. You want your service sector to understand how to reduce emissions, how to work with small businesses to reduce emissions. You want to develop clean energy technologies and, in general, be a leader in what will certainly be one of the largest job-creating sectors in the economy. over the next few decades, which is technologies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, from my perspective, the central thing is for California to do what it did, which is to set a target that is very clear. That signal all by itself gets businesses understanding that action is inevitable. And how precisely this gets implemented, I think, you know, I can certainly describe to you what I would expect to happen, but that is going to be a lengthy process of negotiation among a lot of parties in California.
What do you see happening? Perhaps you could go into each of these different sectors, utilities, transportation, agriculture.
If you want to reduce future greenhouse gas emissions, you basically have three strategies. You can use energy more efficiently. So you could, for instance, buy a car that was twice as efficient as the car you owned. If you owned a 20-mile-per-gallon car, you could get a 40-mile-per-gallon. The second strategy is to run your car, building, power plant on a fuel that has less emissions of greenhouse gases than the fuel you were using. So if you had a coal plant, you might switch to a natural gas plant, or if you had a natural gas plant, you could switch to a wind turbine or a solar system. So that's sometimes called fuel switching. And then there is a third strategy, and let me just say, the first two strategies are widely employed today. The third strategy, which is newly emerging, is the possibility that you could capture the carbon dioxide before or after you burned a fossil fuel, and instead of releasing it into the atmosphere, you would somehow store it, or sometimes it's called sequester it, permanently. Probably you would put it in what are called deep underground geologic storage. These are sometimes, you know, very salty, briny aquifers that are far below where we get our water, and it can stay there a very long time, potentially. But no one has done very much of this.
How will the utilities need to change?
Utilities are going to have more aggressive energy efficiency efforts. That's number one. Number two, they are going to have to increase their percentage of power derived from renewable sources. Number three is this issue of, can we build a coal plant where we capture the carbon dioxide and store it permanently? And then there is the fourth issue that the state will have to wrestle with at some point concerning nuclear power, since nuclear power plants do not directly emit carbon dioxide, and they do represent a zero carbon source of power, but obviously in the state and the nation and the world remain a very controversial form of energy.
When you drive on a California freeway, you almost despair of ever changing this overwhelmingly crowded scene and very little public transportation that's really widely used. Do we need to change our habits at the individual and municipal level?
Let me give the near term and then the long term. Clearly, we have demonstrated Toyota with the Prius and Ford with the Escape. You can make a car much more fuel efficient. But ultimately, we are going to need a fuel to run our cars on that releases less carbon dioxide emissions than burning gasoline. And the two obvious choices for me are either electricity or a certain form of ethanol called cellulosic ethanol. And those two represent much cleaner forms of energy to run your car on. And there's a particular type of car called the plug-in hybrid that you may have heard of. It has a gasoline engine and an onboard electric battery storage system, and it can go 20 to 40 miles on electricity, and then you charge it up, and since most people don't use their car for more than, you know, short trips, most of the time you'll actually just be running on the electricity and won't even need to go to a filling station. So then as California cleans up its electric grid, it will then be cleaning up its transportation sector at the same time. Also, you hear a lot about ethanol. Currently, virtually all the ethanol is produced using corn. Corn ethanol really doesn't save you much in the way of greenhouse gases because the agricultural sector is pretty energy intensive. But we are going to make a transition to cellulosic ethanol, and that is ethanol from crop waste and dedicated crops. And I think, in fact, the single biggest contributor that the agricultural sector will ultimately make to global warming is the development of energy crops that you grow, you burn, you release the CO2 when you burn crops, but the next generation of crops take in CO2. Cellulosic ethanol and plug-in hybrids, these are two phrases that if your listeners haven't heard before, they're certainly going to hear a great deal of in the years to come.
I recently heard speeches by both Lester Brown, the founder of World Watch Institute, and Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, both saying that we are entering a period of extraordinary innovation in green technologies, and that that is going to be where the smart money goes in the future. You're going to see a burst of innovation as never before in modern industrial world. Do you see that on the horizon as well?
Oh, I think it is an absolute certainty. I mean, there is an absolute certainty that the world is going to take progressively stronger and stronger action in global warming, because you just have to look around. Look at the wildfires, the heat waves, the tremendous rainstorms, the tremendous hurricanes, the accelerated melting of the glaciers and the Arctic, to see the fact that global warming is clearly happening faster than the scientists expected it would. So, yes, there is no question that whoever is the next president of the United States, global warming will be a top issue, funding will go up, and ultimately it is going to be a race between how smart we are with our technology versus how dumb we have been with our refusal to take action early.
You said earlier that when you realize that something is inevitable, you want to be at the head of the pack moving in that direction. Are you seeing that major industries and major companies are moving aggressively in this direction, not just 1% of their portfolio, but that they're beginning to see both the urgency, and not even on a moral basis or scientific basis, but just the sense that they need to innovate in this direction in order to be where the future will be?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Walmart has made a series of aggressive announcements, including the plan to go 100% renewable electricity. I've dealt with companies like Johnson & Johnson and IBM, and these are companies that are moving very fast towards making their buildings more efficient, buying renewable energy and the like.
There seem to be some very interesting politics here, that it would be a Republican governor in the same party as the party in power in Washington, but his finger picks up a different breeze. What do you see here? Is there a split even among conservatives over the direction to move in?
Conservatives in this country have just, they oppose action on global warming. But that is, you know, not all Republicans are, you know, hardline conservatives. And obviously, you know, Governor Schwarzenegger has demonstrated his willingness to be a leader. And there are governors in the northeastern state, like Governor Pataki of New York, who have taken action, and Democratic governors have also made strong commitments. So it is unfortunate that the country is run by two oil men, because almost any other combination of federal leadership would have resulted in the U.S. at least taking some action. I'm not saying we would necessarily do everything that is needed to avoid catastrophe, but right now we are doing nothing whatsoever, and it is a grave embarrassment to the country and to the world.
So when you look at what California is doing, is the governor and other leaders in California deciding that they want to be at the head of the wave in the country and the world? And is it your view that over the long term, having made this decision, they will not suffer from it, California will not suffer from it, but actually place itself as it did in the computer revolution at the very head of the pack?
I don't want to make it seem like this is easy. Obviously, if it were easy, we would have done it already. But yes, I mean, the state of California has, I think, a history of leadership on clean energy, on energy efficiency, on tough clean air regulations, and on high technology. And it is those four areas that are going to be combined into this one super sector called, you know, carbon reduction or greenhouse gas reduction. And California, I think, is as poised to capitalize on this as any state in the union.
That's an interesting phrase, a super sector, a carbon reduction sector. Are you saying that it sort of bridges across all the old sectors and creates a kind of a common thrust to all of them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, I think people need to understand that if we are to stop the planet from warming, we need to reduce emissions 60 to 80% from current levels. at a time when emissions in the U.S. keep going up and China goes even faster and many countries are developing. So absolutely, you know, we are talking about a sector, we are talking about every sector of the economy by, in our lifetime certainly, but inevitably by mid-century will be green. I mean, there will not be any sectors of the economy that haven't been greened up in the year 2050, because if we don't do that, the consequences are, you know, are dire, and one just has to read the newspapers to follow that.
All sectors will be green, the entire economy. On the one hand, that sounds like a an environmentalist utopia, but I take it that that will not be utopia. It will just be, it will enable us to sort of get by the skin of our teeth into the future.
Well, the country's leading climate scientist, James Hansen, has said we have a decade to act. Yes, we are on a precipice. If we, the next president can follow the lead of Governor Schwarzenegger, then I think we will escape the worst of it by the skin of our teeth. But if we sit on our hands for another 10 years, then I think we will lose the Greenland ice sheet eventually, and we'll be consigning future generations to sea levels that are 20 to 80 foot higher, and wildfires and droughts, and inexcusable. It will be inexcusable that we fail to act. So, yes, whether it's a utopia or not, you know, humans have always dreamed of a utopia. I think our goal should not, is, you know, not to create a utopia, but to avoid a dystopia.
Joseph Rome, former Assistant Secretary of Energy. I'm Mark Summer, and this is A World of Possibilities, distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.
Digital audio on your desktop.
Computers can do that?
The Classic Rock Web Stream from 94.7 WCSX.
Thank you.
classic rock around the world.
The WCSX Classic Rock web stream.
Spin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, as reports from Iraq become increasingly dire, U.S. policymakers and their media enablers are looking everywhere but at themselves for someone to blame. Nation columnist and New York correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper, Gary Young, writes about the finger-pointing in his latest Guardian column. They lied their way into Iraq, now they are trying to lie their way out. We'll hear from him. Also on Counterspin today, politicians and pundits tend to agree that solving the Israel-Palestine conflict would go a long way towards achieving peace in the broader Middle East. But that's about where the agreement ends. A new book by activist and frequent Counterspin guest Ali Abu Nima suggests a new path, one that's almost never discussed in the mainstream media. Ali Abu Nima spoke with Counterspin's Peter Hart about his new book, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
In a November 24th Washington Post column, Charles Krauthammer recycled a deceptively edited quote by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez that made Chavez appear to be voicing an anti-Semitic slur. Krauthammer began the column by chiding actor Sacha Baron Cohen and his film Borat for targeting small-time anti-Semitism and then listed what he saw as more menacing instances of anti-Semitism. Among them, a Chavez quote saying that, quote, descendants of the same ones that crucified Christ, close quote, have, quote, taken possession of all the wealth of the world, close quote. But that supposed slur was debunked by Fair last January when the quotes first circulated. As Fair pointed out, Chavez's reference also included the descendants of those who expelled Bolivar from Venezuela as being among those representing, quote, less than 10% of the world population who own more than half of the riches of the world, close quote. Chavez was obviously referring generically to the wealthy and powerful, but by Krauthammer's reading, one would conclude that Chavez thinks Jews persecuted Simón Bolívar and account for 600 million of the world's population. At the time, American rabbi Arthur Waskow defended Chavez, telling the Associated Press, quote, I know of no one who accuses the Jews of fighting against Bolivar, close quote. And Fair's Alert noted that the Confederation of Jewish Associations of Venezuela was joined by the American Jewish Committee and the American Jewish Congress in pointing out that Chavez was not referring to Jews in his speech. So this would appear to be another case in which a Washington Post columnist believes he is entitled to not just his own opinions, but also his own facts.
Lawrence Kaplan starts off his November 27th column for the New Republic, making a point about how, with news outlets shuttering their Baghdad bureaus, Americans are getting less direct news from Iraq, leaving them to color what facts they do get with their imagination. Quote, or worse, to let Frank Rich or Rush Limbaugh or a pisher with a website do the coloring for them, close quote. Relying on Kaplan, however, could lead to important misunderstandings as well. His column, The Troops and Us, argues that for most Americans, Iraq is just an abstraction and that their groundless chatterings are worlds away from the views of the U.S. military personnel serving there. Kaplan enjoins readers, for the sake of American soldiers, quote, who speak with a sense of ownership about their war and see themselves as a progressive force on the Iraqi landscape, and who, according to surveys by the Military Times and the Pew Research Center, hold opinions on the war that run almost exactly counter to those registered at home, be grateful that the machinery of war overwhelms the din from Washington, close quote. While there may be something to be said about a disconnect between those who know what's happening in Iraq and those who don't, but this isn't it. Kaplan might well refer to the nitpicker blogger as a pisher with a website, but he did take the time to do what the New Republic evidently didn't, which was check those military polls Kaplan refers to. It turns out the Military Times hasn't conducted a poll for over a year, and the last one, which the group underscored did not represent the whole military, showed just a 10-point higher approval rate for the war than among the general U.S. population. As for Pew Research Center, they told Nitpicker that Kaplan simply had it wrong. They hadn't done a survey of military personnel on their opinions of the war. The only groups the blogger could find that had done such a survey, Zogby and Le Moyne College, have found most recently that nearly three-quarters of the troops in Iraq felt that the U.S. should leave the country within a year at the latest.
There's plenty going on in Afghanistan, a massive increase in NATO aerial bombing, civilian deaths, increased violence and suicide bombings, and a booming opium trade. The fact that few news outlets still have reporters in the country means the American public remains mostly unaware of these developments. So when a major network sends a correspondent to Afghanistan, it would seem a natural opportunity to get a handle on a largely forgotten war. But NBC didn't seem to think so. NBC Nightly News correspondent Jim Maceda's November 26th dispatch skipped over the ongoing violence in that country. That was quickly summarized by anchor John Siegenthaler, in order to present a warm, upbeat story about American soldiers winning the battle for local support. Maceda profiled one soldier who, quote, has never met an Afghan child he hasn't waved to, smiled at, or high-fived, close quote. If that sounds like NBC's missing the point, if not the real story, just consider Maceda's other report from Afghanistan just a few days earlier. The subject, Operation Hot Turkey, Thanksgiving dinner for U.S. soldiers.
With the new Democratic Congress promising to let the Medicare prescription drug program negotiate lower prices from drug companies, those companies have gotten their friends in the media to find some reason, any reason, why this would be a bad idea. The Washington Post, happy to defend corporate profits, declared in the lead paragraph of a front-page November 26th article that Democrats were in danger of, quote, wrecking a program that is proven cheaper and more popular than anyone imagined, unquote. Cheaper than anyone imagined? Only if that anyone doesn't include the White House itself, which once imagined that the 10-year cost of the program would be less than $400 billion. The latest 10-year estimate, $678 billion. It's true that the projected cost for 2006 was reduced significantly, but the biggest reason for this cost reduction was that far fewer people than expected signed up for the plan. But wait, isn't it more popular than anyone imagined? On that point, the Post article cited polls saying that more than 80% of enrollees are satisfied. But those questions were about whether they were satisfied with the plan they'd chosen under the program, not how happy they were with the program itself. A Wall Street Journal Harris poll released November 20th, for example, found 75% of enrollees were satisfied with their plan, but only 59% gave a positive rating to the program. And those who enroll, of course, are more positive than those who are eligible but don't enroll. Among all people over 65, only 47% give the Medicare drug program positive marks. When you create a program costing hundreds of billions of dollars to benefit a particular group, you might think that more than half of that group ought to be happy with the results. If they're not, then is an effort to change the program really cause for a page one alarm about wrecking it?
In a recent FAIR study of PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, sources who preferred to stay the course in Iraq outnumbered those who favored withdrawal by more than 5-1. That disparity was striking, especially when polls showed a greater percentage of the public favoring withdrawal than staying the course. That was months ago, and times have changed. The midterm election swept Democrats into power on what nearly all observers saw as a resounding vote against the Iraq war. So how is the NewsHour covering the debate over Iraq policy now? On November 20th, host Jim Lehrer presented what he called, quote, our own version of the debate, two men who've advised President Bush on Iraq policy this year, close quote. Two Bush advisors squaring off. That could be a debate, but neither the guest, Fred Kagan of the right-wing American Enterprise Institute, or Michael Vickers of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, advocated withdrawal. Kagan favored troop increases, while Vickers mostly parried, saying we don't have enough troops to send more. As Lehrer seemed to say, this sort of narrow spectrum is exactly the kind of debate the NewsHour prefers. And for a public that favors troop withdrawals? Well, it seems they need to go somewhere other than public TV's flagship newscast to hear anything like their own views.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of the most contested issues for media watchers. Pro-Israel lobbying groups have successfully disciplined outlets that have reported the issue contrary to their wishes, and it's common to hear reporters and columnists say that there is no other single story that evokes such strong reactions. That would suggest, then, that the discussion of the issue that does make it into print or on the airwaves is severely limited, leaving important history, context, and solutions off the table. A new book by frequent Counterspin guest Ali Abu Nima outlines one such vision. The book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali Abu Nima, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Now, your new book proposes an idea that is almost unmentionable in political and media circles, that the solution to this conflict lies in the creation of a single state. You've debated the Mideast for years in the media with reporters and cable news hosts. You know this terrain. To say this is an uphill battle, I think, is an understatement. What led you to this argument that you lay out in the book?
Well, actually, I have a feeling that there's a lot more support and interest in this solution than you would be led to believe. I think that there is this sort of blanket media conventional wisdom that is supported by what I call a multi-billion dollar peace process industry to make people believe that the only possible solution is the division, the partition of Palestine, Israel into separate states. And despite this massive investment in partition, no partition seems achievable. We seem further away from the creation of a Palestinian state, and Israel seems sort of less and less viable over time than ever before. But when I've gone out and talked to people over recent years, both Palestinians, Israelis, American Jews, and others who are interested, people are saying, well, what are the alternatives? Why are we stuck in this rut? And this book is an attempt to really break open that discussion.
Why don't we talk about it? Are we just too far down the road or the roadmap to look back?
When I look at the responses I've gotten when I've gone into the media to talk about this issue, I think there is a lot of interest. But one sort of standard counter you get is, oh, you're talking about the destruction of Israel. That's a standard tactic used to silence this discussion. Of course, I'm not talking about the destruction of Israel. I'm talking about how can we provide for a dignified life for all Israelis and all Palestinians who are already living in the same country. It's not talking about creating one country. It's talking about recognizing the reality that it's one country and redressing the injustices and inequalities that have made peace with justice so elusive. So one of the tactics that has been used to steer discussion away from this is to claim that anything other than a discussion of the two-state solution is tantamount to calling for the destruction of Israel. And that has effectively silenced a lot of people and scared them off looking at solutions. And in the book, I try to explore other models, taking inspiration from Northern Ireland, from Belgium, from Canada, from other places that have had to deal with similar conflicts, and to stop treating Israelis and Palestinians as if they are so unique and so exceptional that, you know, we always have to treat them with kid gloves.
I wanted to ask you about that because there is this tendency, I think, you know, anti-Arab racism is certainly well established in the American media. That would seem to be a tremendous obstacle. It fosters this notion that, sure, people can live together in peace, but Arabs are different. There's something about this story that makes it, and this conflict that makes it different than South Africa, different than certainly Ireland.
I examine that in the book, and mm-hmm. with respect to South Africa, it's interesting that the arguments that were made against democracy in South Africa were the same. They were always this racialized discourse, this civilizational discourse, like, oh, you Europeans can lecture us whites in South Africa about democracy, but you don't know what it's like here. The people here are different. They are less civilized. They would slaughter us the minute they got their hands on the levers of power. The same is true in Northern Ireland, where the discourse that was used to justify very discriminatory measures against the Catholic nationalist population in Northern Ireland was the same. It was always about a civilizational, racialized discourse. And this is no different. People in power always justify their power by having some sort of superior claim. And what I examine in the book and try to learn the lessons from is how that changed in South Africa, how they were able to get beyond that.
Near the end of the book, you cited New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. He was reacting to the construction of this wall in the West Bank. He called for a quick two-state solution. He seemed to fear that otherwise there would be a movement among Palestinians and others to favor a single state approach. What would that single state look like? Is there anything to fear, as Friedman seemed to wonder?
Well, there is something to fear if your interest is to preserve an unjust monopoly on economic, military, and political power that the Israeli Jewish people currently hold. If the goal is to afford a dignified life for all the people in the country, to say, as I say in the book, Palestine, Israel belongs to all who live in it, which includes Israeli Jews and Palestinians and all the other peoples who live in it, because it is and has always been a very diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society, then I think there's nothing to fear. Does that mean it's easy? No, of course not. A group giving up power always has fear that the tables will be turned on them. And that's why I focus a lot on examining how in South Africa and in other countries mechanisms were put in place. What was the process of negotiation? What had to change in the way people thought about the other for them not to have those sort of fears and to feel that they could go forward into a more hopeful future?
You mention at the end of the book there is this debate, very tentative one perhaps, within Israeli and Palestinian circles to talk about this. The next step, you say, should be to amplify this debate. One place to do that, of course, is the media. Are you hopeful this can happen in the media, or do you think it's going to have to happen kind of outside that?
So far, it's mostly happened outside the media, and I've been very, very excited by the reaction I've gotten going around and just talking to people about the book and talking to Palestinians, talking to Israelis, talking to others in the country. A lot of people say to me, why isn't this being talked about in the media? Why isn't it being talked about by politicians? So I think that it's sort of out there in the country that this will happen first. But I'm hopeful it will happen in the media too. I think that this issue has reached such a dead end. I think there is the beginnings of a clamor for a new way to talk about it. So I'm not at all pessimistic. As difficult as it is, I'm certainly not going to give up trying to have this discussion in the media.
We've been speaking with Ali Abunima. He is the co-creator and editor of Electronic Intifada and Electronic Iraq. His new book, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, is out now from Metropolitan Books. Ali Abunima, thanks for joining us on Counterspin.
It's my pleasure.
As Iraq sinks even further into bloodshed, war makers and their media supporters are looking for scapegoats, someone to blame for the catastrophe. In the media, for instance, Bill O'Reilly, a super hawk who predicted the war would be over in a matter of weeks, blames the Iraqis. Quote, "The problem in Iraq is not American. The problem is the Iraqis themselves. They're not fighting for their freedom. There is only so much the USA can do," close quote. But the crude, factually challenged Fox anchor is just one of many among U.S. political and media elites pointing fingers at everyone but those who launched and promoted the war. Gary Young, the New York correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper and a columnist for The Nation magazine, has been observing this phenomenon, writing in a November 27th Guardian column, quote, "Those who lied their way into this war are now trying to lie their way out," close quote. Gary Young joins us now by phone. Gary Young, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
A November 29th Washington Post report begins, quote, "From troops on the ground to members of Congress, Americans increasingly blame the continuing violence and destruction in Iraq on the people most affected by it, the Iraqis," close quote. The recently released Hadley memo, where Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, lists the perceived faults of Iraq Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, seems to be a variation on this same theme. Gary Young, is this what you mean when you write those who lied their way into this war are now trying to lie their way out?
In part, yes. I mean, first of all, everybody has to take responsibility for what they do. We can't ignore the fact that Iraqis are the people who are pulling the trigger most commonly on Iraqis at the moment. That said, the reason that Iraq is in the situation as it is because of the invasion. And there is a sense that kind of what the left wants to do is to keep rubbing people's faces in the fact that they lied to, you know, to go to war, and let's all just move on and deal with the way it is. But actually, you can't solve this situation unless you understand the problem, and the problem is the invasion. So if you don't accept that the invasion was the problem, then you have to look somewhere else. And so they start now to blame the victim. And they do that without any sense of how does a country which has had its entire army disbanded, its entire civil service disbanded, is under occupation, how does that society then fight for anything? How does it kind of even exist in some kind of coherent space? How does its civil society assert itself? Of course it doesn't, notwithstanding the fact that's after decades of dictatorship, 3 years of occupation, and years of colonialism and monarchy before that. So the reason that Iraq is in this situation is because of the invasion, and it's not that the Iraqis aren't ready for democracy. They were never ready for invasion.
So in precisely what sense is blaming Iraq or al-Maliki lying?
It's refusing to take responsibility for what the West has done. It suggests that al-Maliki has more power than in fact he does. America runs Iraq. Al-Maliki really doesn't. And it says that the original problem is not the invasion. It's not that there's an occupying force. It's that the Iraqis aren't ready for prime time. The way that it's lying is that it chooses a reason for the failure in Iraq that actually has nothing to do with why things are failing in Iraq. And so it absolves the West of any responsibility for what they've done.
In your Guardian column, you note that this finger-pointing in the U.S. is not limited to Republicans, and you cite incoming Democratic congressional whip Steny Hoyer blaming Iraqis for the situation they're in. Well, in the same theme of finger-pointing, fairly crude demonization is often a part of war, and you've noted some renewed efforts of that sort recently on the cover of Newsweek magazine.
Well, yeah, it's the whole enemy of the month club thing. There was the long-lost and long-forgotten Osama bin Laden, and then there was Saddam Hussein, and then there was this pack of 55 cards, and then it was Zarqawi. Each person that they kill, it really doesn't seem to capture, it doesn't really seem to make much difference what's going on the ground. And now it's a Muqtada al-Sadr. The picture of him on Newsweek has him looking as much like a demon as a man possibly could without, you know, the horns and the trident. The issue here is not whether Muqtada al-Sadr is a good person or a bad person or whether one supports him or not. In terms of the political reality on the ground in Iraq, it is fairly clear that Muqtada al-Sadr is a key player. And so one needs to understand him, and we don't get to understand him any better if we dress him up as the enemy of this month. That doesn't help kind of understand what's going on the ground in Iraq.
To read U.S. press, some sort of miraculous solution may come from a man ingenuously being called Mr. Fix-It, James Baker, in the Iraq Study Group. As we speak on November 30th, the story is broken. They've leaked the details of what the Iraq Study Group's recommendations are. What do you make of the coverage of this?
One thing I think is interesting about the coverage of it is that it's rarely pointed out that the fact that this study group was necessary itself highlights a flaw, I think, in American politics, that democracy should have been able to deal with this, not an appointed commission. Had there been oversight in Congress, that should have been the Iraq Study Group. Congress, to me, it's been about managing expectations. And so it's been kind of covered in terms of leaks and, you know, little glimpses of what they might do. And I think, and to this extent, it's been covered kind of, this has been covered fairly reasonable. This is presented as some kind of face-saving device, which I think it is, for some way of the Bush administration climbing down from its current position. What's really been peculiar is that this has happened simultaneously alongside Bush's continued assertion that nothing's going to change, we're going to stay the course, and so on. So it looks like there's going to be more conflict down the pike between Bush and this group.
Well, we're running out of time, but on the subject of the lack of public discussion and debate, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the biggest differences you've noted between U.S. coverage and that in the rest of the world, and mainly in Great Britain?
Well, let's talk about Britain. Britain has the peculiar and disingenuous comfort, British people, of blaming much of this on the Bush administration. Disingenuous because, of course, Britain completely enabled the Bush administration. They were the people who gave their drunk friend the car keys and said, you know, you go ahead and, you know, have a safe trip home. And so there is a degree of smugness in that. But that otherwise, there is a gradual unraveling. There is a sense of an unraveling and a distancing. And so Britain has been talking about, you know, when it's going to withdraw. And there is a sense of America really being on its own now, more and more. And that's certainly true from the British coverage. It's no longer like, what are we going to do about this? And it's more like, what's Bush going to do about this? And that is, to some extent, aided by the fact that the areas that Britain occupies are not the most contentious areas. And so there's been more of a sense in recent months that this is an internal problem for the U.S. to deal with. As far as international wars go, there's been lots more concern and coverage, not more than Iraq, but more than there has been about Afghanistan.
We've been speaking with Gary Young, New York correspondent for The Guardian newspaper of London and columnist for The Nation magazine. Gary Young, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Streaming audio
from your classic rock home in cyberspace.
94.7 WCSX.
Up some cheap sunglasses. Was a cheap sunglasses.
Audio on your desktop. The Classic Rock web stream from 94.7 WCSX.
More ways to manage your cash flow. Your choice, your Chase.
A Chase business checking account and Chase on-